Hello and welcome to the Interfish Podcast, where we bring you the week's most interesting and compelling seafood news. I'm Drew Cherry, Editor-in-Chief, and I am joined today by Executive Editor John Fiorillo, Correspondent John Evans. Let's dive right into a couple of the hottest topics that have been on our minds that we're excited to talk about today. First off, let's talk about Young's Seafood. Now, Young's Seafood, for those that are not Brits, is the largest supplier of seafood in the UK. It's an iconic brand. If you grew up in other parts of Europe, it might be like Findus or Igloo. If you grew up in the United States, it would be Gorton's and Van de Kamp's, but a lot more than that, because Young's does a wide variety of products, including frozen, but also some chilled items as well. So anyway, Young's, a few years ago, in the midst of trying to sell the company, looking for a couple of wins, a couple of ways to highlight the company's ability to grow, they launched products into the U.S. market. It was an unusual move. It was much heralded. Again, maybe for obvious reasons, they were looking for proof that they had beyond just a UK reach. So the products went into the market. They partnered with a Pennsylvania-based group called the Fishin' Company, which is in many ways kind of a funnel directly into the Walmart and Sam's Club system. So the products were carried. There was social media around it. There was a lot of excitement. They attended the Boston Seafood Show to show off their wares. Now, John Fiorillo and our colleague Dominic Welling checked in and saw how the products are doing. And John, tell us how they were doing and what you found out.
Sure. Well, we checked in largely because we saw on their Facebook page, Young's USA set up this Facebook page when they launched in 2018 into the market. We were seeing posts like, I can't find the product anymore. Where's the product? What happened to the product? So that got us curious and we started to dive in. And lo and behold, we got it confirmed that Walmart is no longer carrying it. And Walmart's significant, not only for the 3,900 stores in which it was initially carrying it, but because that was the backbone of this this effort to expand overseas, first in the U.S., and plans later called for expansion into China and elsewhere. So losing Walmart was, you know, losing a limb, so to speak. It was pretty much a crushing blow. Now, it is still in some retail outlets, as far as we can tell, from their websites, because they list it as a product on their websites. But, you know, nothing to the level of what Walmart distribution would have been. So it appears they're out. They don't want to talk about it, Young's, that is. Fishin' Co. and neither. They don't want to talk about it either. So, that's kind of where we are. You know, their strategy, according to research they did, was that the U.S. frozen fish finger, you know, breaded fish category was ready for something new, some innovation besides anything that Gorton's tossed out, because Gorton's is the giant in the U.S. in that category. And they thought they could bring a British feel, kind of, ooh, the British fish and chips thing to it. And they also, and this is kind of important, they also were touting a better product in the sense that it had more fish to breading ratio. So that was, you know, a selling point in their eyes as well.
So, okay, so cracking into a very, I wouldn't say crowded, but like you said, John, Gorton's, the frozen giant here, and Van de Kamp's, which is also large. It's not easy, and it's never been historically easy for anybody to launch into the frozen seafood category in the United States for a lot of different reasons. But what's your take on why they didn't make this happen?
You know, it's hard to tell without being able to get some insight from Gorton's. I mean, we spoke to a lot of people, mostly background, that had some familiarity with it. But it is perplexing because you would think they launched in 2018, COVID hit in early 2020, and frozen seafood sales went through the roof. But I think... So you think they would have been able to make it, but I think things had already decelerated before that. If you look at their social media traffic, for example, on that website I mentioned earlier, it was strong in 18, strong in 19, really started to taper off in 20, and they've done three posts in 2021, and these posts are like recipes and other kind of consumer driven social media posts. So why it didn't make it, or why it's making it at such a level that they didn't anticipate, I don't know. I mean, there's been turnover, obviously, at Young's. There's been turnover at the Fish & Co. I don't know if that has anything to do with it. You know, I don't know about that argument that it was some sort of ploy, if you will, to kind of just dress the company up for sale. I don't know how much that plays into it, if at all. So, you know, it's really hard to tell.
So, John Evans, just moving over to you, because you said in on the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute All Hands meeting. And interesting enough, John and Dominic's story came up in a question to Dan Ahern. He's the CEO of New England Seafood International, which is a UK company actually owned by an Alaska Native corporation. What did Dan have to say? I mean, he addressed it fairly directly about why Young's may have failed.
Yeah, he said it was a lesson, really, in the complexities of understanding the nuances of overseas consumers, and that you really, if you're going to operate in a foreign market, you can't just send the product out and hope. You know, you really have to be fully in or not in there at all. I mean, he pointed to the long heritage of Young's products understood by British consumers. And he said he was surprised in the first place to see the company target the United States with the brand. And he wasn't really certain who the brand was speaking to in the US consumer base. And, if the backing was there to support it, to make it, to help make it be understood. As you mentioned, Young's, before they embarked on this, they touted consumer research showing U.S. consumers were ready for new products. But, in the end, as John alluded to also, Ahern said that perhaps Safina's strength in the North American market may have been behind the decision to pull back from the U.S. market with Young's. He suspects that under Sofina ownership, the capabilities that Young's has in value adding may be used in a different way by Sofina, or it may be different executions of a similar offer. So we'll have to see how that plays out, really.
Now, one thing we haven't discussed is if there's any lingering resentment over 1776, if that has anything to do with this, I don't know.
Of course, that's the bottom line right
that
there.
Could be. Americans, know how to hold a grudge, I guess. But it's very interesting because I think that brands in general, it's always been difficult for the seafood industry to brand. In the UK, there's so many private labels So many of those retailers do such a good job with their private labels, and it's so core, and consumers are really used to it. John Evans, you wrote a story not too long ago about brands, on sort of how to make brands work and what's really needed. And part of that too, in your piece that I found really interesting, was there seems to be a general lack of understanding about what even a brand is, correct?
Yeah, this came up a couple of months ago in September when we looked at Multi-Export's decision to change the company name to Multi-X. And one of the branding experts I spoke to said to me, the first thing you have to understand is what a brand is and what, you know, who it's aimed at, et cetera, et cetera. Companies tend to, on occasion, get mixed messages, and the brand name should not only resonate with the audience, but be something that the company leadership can get behind and believe in, for example. A company bringing in new leadership team might want to say that was the oldest and put that behind them, drawing a line in the sand. And you can even, point the way to changing internal communication. So, brands have many sort of roles to play. And, brand equity, which is the positive consumer perception of a company's brand name or product, can take years to build up. So in the case of Young's, maybe they didn't have enough time, or, as we alluded to earlier, financial effort put behind it.
Yeah, and I'm thinking about what Dan Ahern said too, that brands exist in the hearts and minds of consumers, which I think is an interesting way to put it. I think sometimes that's the case, but it's a shame, because I do think that the U.S. industry and just the frozen seafood category in general really lacks innovation, and in a period like this where people have been reintroduced to frozen seafood. People are willing to try cooking frozen fish more. It's too bad. It would seem like there's more opportunities, than there have been in the past. And maybe this, there's been a little bit of dew off the rose on frozen at retail. So it could be now that we're going to see a more of a return to normal, but we'll see. But an interesting adventure for Young's. They're certainly not the only one. Saucy Fish, which is increasingly seeming like something that the new Sea Chill owners, it's a group called Hilton Seafood in the UK. Saucy Fish, for those of you that remember it, was really well received. It had an appeal to maybe younger consumers. It was exciting packaging and kind of new flavors. But it appears that it's really fallen by the wayside. They also attempted to enter into the U.S. market and made a few good steps, but then completely pulled out in 2019, just because they couldn't really get it to take in the way that they wanted to. And then also Nomad Foods has sent over the Findus brand as well as the Igloo brand as well into the U.S. market. So there does seem to be some awareness that there is an opportunity there. It would be great to see U.S. consumers have a little bit more choice. So maybe there will be more of that in the future.
Brand owners often forget, especially in the international context, that even if their brand is very famous and loved in one market, for example, a product like Marmite in Britain, the yeast spread, it doesn't automatically apply to other markets. And if a brand doesn't tick the boxes of what makes a brand successful, all kinds of things can trip it up, and the company's launching it.
Yeah, and I'm thinking too about, seafood branding has always been tough. But let's go to the canned tuna aisle just for a second, because probably the three most famous seafood brands are in that aisle: Bumblebee, Chicken of the Sea, Starkist. They kind of go back and forth for who's number one. The sales in that category tend to be price driven. So even those companies that have been around for decades have not built that much brand loyalty amongst consumers. And in fact, you see more private label on those shelves now too. And every week there's a price promotion. One week it's Starkist, one week it's, you know, so building brand loyalty in seafood has always been difficult, and it doesn't appear that it's getting any easier at all to me.
All right, so let's move away from branding and start talking about a topic we began talking about last week, but sometimes topics just stay hot, and alternative seafood is one of those. So yes, it seems like it's reared its ugly head again. The discussion and debate over how plant-based and cell-cultured or cell-based seafood should all be labeled. And it's been really interesting to hear the different viewpoints on this. And I think my thinking on it has evolved a little bit as I've heard more of both sides. So I'm curious to talk to you about this, John. You kind of got things going a little bit this time around with a commentary that you produced, and we discussed that last week. But things continued on. We got a guest commentary from John Connolly of the National Fisheries Institute, who we had cited from a presentation he had given. So what now? A lot of people jumped into the discussion, the debate. A lot of people were on LinkedIn discussing it. And what's your takeaway for what the future might look like for labeling of these alternative seafoods?
Well, certainly the passions are running high. John's guest column that we published got a rebuttal column from David Benziquin, who at one time was the co-founder of Ocean Hugger. And you'll remember that company was kind of one of the first ones to market with a plant-based salmon sushi product. They were at the Boston Seafood Show once, and I think he's not there any longer, as far as I know, and the company has gone through some changes. But he bounced back with a pretty stern rebuttal to John, and it, like you said, it just took off in social media. So, I mean, I don't really know. As I said in my column a few weeks back, plant-based seafood, alternative seafood sales of plant-based products are $12 million a year right now. Regular, you know, traditional seafood sales in the U.S. are $100 billion. I just see that as such a massive gap that this kind of, you know, worry about labeling seems a little off point to me. But
I was going to, I'm going to butt in. I was more on that side of the equation. And I think, a couple of years ago, you were, you really kind of pioneered the coverage on this and were one of the first to dive into it. And I remember our discussions and me kind of rolling my eyes at you a little bit and saying, really, is this really going to be a thing? And you were right. It was a thing. But at the time, I kind of said, you know, the industry is really trying to blame its own lack of innovation on this kind of boogeyman of plant-based seafood. And to a certain extent, I can still kind of see, and that was what a lot of the comments were about this topic was, well, the seafood industry just doesn't want to innovate. Maybe there's some truth to that. However, one thing that did kind of, and I'd heard these statistics before, but I think that Connolly put it in an interesting way of, you know, wanting to begin this discussion now before 2030, when it becomes, you know, a real issue. And I think that is, I think that's relevant. I kind of saw, you know, in my mind, I thought, okay, well, on a longer timeline, and given the slow pace of bureaucracy and getting labeling laws and things through government institutions, that maybe it does make sense to put a little more attention on it. I don't know that there's particular urgency now. And I'll ask you that, John, because it was interesting. There's been some earnings that have come out recently of companies that own plant-based brands, and it hasn't been all rosy.
Yeah. First off, John Connolly gets paid to think down the road 5-10 years. So hats off to him for doing so in this case, because he's trying to look out and protect the industry which he represents. So I totally understand where he's coming from on that point. And, you know, if you look at some of the labels, as we did in that one column, you know, I mean, they can fool consumers, I suppose. I would think it'd be obvious, you know, but it isn't obvious to everybody. So, you know, they'll continue to pursue that. But to go back to my earlier point on the size of this sector, you were referencing some companies and their earnings. Beyond Meat, for example, their stock price sank 17% yesterday because Wall Street started to raise alarms about the company's growth prospects. They're the sector leader. I mean, they are the big kahuna. So if they're starting to struggle, I think sales were off. All the metrics were off. And it hasn't just been this quarter. It was the quarter before and kind of even before that. In addition, Maple Leaf Foods, which is a massive protein producer, you know, meat, chicken, da-da-da, they came out in one of their quarterly statements earlier this month and said they're reassessing their investments in plant-based proteins. So, you know, is this the start of trouble for this sector? And if the big guys like the meat guys, who have been extraordinarily successful getting their product into the mainstream, if they're not going to be able to make it, certainly the seafood guys, who are, you know, a drop in the bucket, aren't going to be able to do it, in my opinion. But, you know, again, John gets paid to look out for his members. And if he thinks this is an issue, you know, who am I to argue with him?
Yeah, it's hard to know if there is any, obviously there's some sales slowdown that's in black and white, but I still don't see this category as running out of steam by any stretch of the imagination. If anything, there's going to be more innovation. There'll be consolidation and things like that. But you do see major companies, when they start jumping in, they can bring a lot of muscle. When a Tyson or a Nestle gets into it, which they have, they have the muscle and they have the strength to get their products listed in these major retailers, which is what it needs. You know, these products need exposure, they need marketing, yeah, and there needs to be awareness. So,
but these products are everywhere I shop, and Maple Leaf is no tiny company. It's 4, 5, 6 billion. I can't remember, but so I think that's already happening. And two other points I would make is, when you look at NFI's strategy and what it's doing with the cell cultured seafood sector, which is emerging. And if you don't know what that is, you basically take a fish cell and grow it into, say, a portion or a fillet or some piece of seafood in a lab instead of in the ocean, right? So, and that is seafood. That's not plants. That is legit seafood. Okay. So what NFI has done with that sector is meet with them, build a kind of a round table, and they are working on labeling guidelines for when this product really emerges. It's only now starting to kind of hit the market. Well, it's not even really in the market, but it's coming. So my other point is there are some big seafood companies already partnering with plant-based and cell culture companies. Bumblebee, Rich Products, which owns Rich CPAC, Nomad, probably some others I can't think of at the moment. So it's a little curious to me why NFI is being so proactive with the cell culture guys, but yet is in what really looks like an escalating battle with the plant-based guys.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, and I think that it'll be something that we'll cover more, just because we'll have to cover it more as the industry evolves. But the cell-cultured, cell-based sector, that is going to change things, I believe, dramatically. And it will probably happen quicker than we think. Plant-based it's been around a long time. Plant-based foods and plant-based seafood has been around a long, long time. It's just been sold to kind of niche audiences. It's more to me about, you know, the trend towards plant-based eating and the, what the awareness of carbon footprints, the awareness of, sustainability and in our relationship to the resources, the planet. And that's why probably plant-based is not going anywhere, but I think it's got a lot to sort out for sure. And I agree, the labeling is one where there's some of those that you mentioned in your column, John, and showed the packaging of it where it just seems, it does seem designed to confuse. And I know that NFI has brought up this example of milk over and over and over, which is getting, you know, a little tiresome to hear about. But then you look at the numbers and you kind of realize why they keep bringing it up. And it's become so mainstream, you don't think about it. You go to the store and there's your almond milk, there's your coconut milk, there's your soy milk. You just don't think about it. It's just right there. And they ended up taking a significant portion of that category. Different situation, but at the same time, if you're in an industry, and as you said, if you're a trade association, you need to be aware of these things and thinking about them.
Yeah, well, as a milk lover, and I mean dairy milk, not the fake milk, I've watched that carefully, and I don't have the statistics, but I do recall that the milk consumption was already in decline in a pretty steep way before the emergence of these milk lookalikes or whatever you want to call them. So I don't know that it's completely, influenced by the emergence of them, but they definitely have taken a bite. I want to go back on one last thing, because you mentioned, you know, these concerns about terrestrial animals and fish and their impact on the climate, raising them and the impact on the climate. I don't think plant-based foods have really been scrutinized fully as far as their impact. I mean, these grow, right? They're beans and lentils and all those things. They grow, they take water, they have a carbon footprint, da-da-da-da-da. Additionally, and John Connolly brings this up often, the nutrition profile of these products hasn't really been fully explored either, at least in a lot of people's opinion, because they are extremely processed foods. And, you know, as I said before, any dietitian will tell you, stay out of the center of the grocery store and just shop the fresh around the edges. But so, you know, anything processed has to get either salt or sugar or both jammed into it. And you know, a lot of that isn't good for diets of many Americans or many people around the world. So, There's probably some reckoning coming in those two areas for plant-based in particular. So we'll see.
Well, it's going to be fascinating to follow. I wouldn't have guessed a few years ago that this would be an issue that would be so important to the industry, or that it would grow the way that it has. But it certainly is. And I, you know, the thing about these types of disruptive products in any industry is they tend to result in change. They tend to force established companies to try something new. And so you are seeing, as you mentioned at the top of the podcast, John, you're seeing companies either embracing it by launching their own lines, partnering. So that's one way to go about it. Another way to go about it, and I think this is a key lesson that can be learned, is the seafood industry should take a look at how these products are marketing themselves, for a couple of reasons. For one, the marketing is oftentimes based around the seafood industry's problems and enhancing and discussing those more, highlighting those more. And that is a danger, because those messages tend to eventually, they're already out there. Things like overfishing, for example, or, you know, negative, information on aquaculture. So they're just sort of expounding on those and hammering those over and over to get, to bring people into their, category and talking about carbon footprint and all these other things. Which, as you just said, may or may not actually play in favor of plant-based. But the other thing to be aware of, I think, is just how they're marketing the products to consumers, full stop, which is they're using social media a lot. This is targeting millennials and younger. The packaging is different and fun, and the story that they're trying to tell is really tied into what consumers care about. This actually goes back to Young's tanking in the U.S. market, for example, and what Ahern said about the hearts and minds is, if you really do want to reach a new set of consumers, you really need to think about how successful brands are doing that. Now, these small plant-based brands are not successful yet. However, they're moving very, very quickly and getting a lot of attention very quickly because of the marketing techniques they're using, because of how they have a mastery of social media, and just the feeling that you get about these brands it's so clear where they're positioned and so clear what the consumer can expect. And that's really why I think seafood brands have struggled.
Well, let me just add just a couple things to that. Nothing, absolutely nothing pisses me off more than when those products use perceived shortcomings in the seafood sector to promote their products. It really ticks me off. I believe if your product's so good, you shouldn't have to, you know, denigrate a competitor's product to sell yours. So that aspect of their marketing, I can't disagree with more. It's horrible to me. And what they do is what the NGOs used to do when they wanted to, you know, get to the industry. They'd take a fact, or not even a fact, they take a statistic and twist it and make it look worse than it is. Overfishing is a great example. So, you know, they're using those tactics. And those, to me, that's just lousy. That's just cowardly. You know, if your fish, plant-based fish nuggets are so good, then, you know, let's talk about that. The other thing is, you know, when it does come to the environment, almond milk's a great example. Do you know how wasteful growing almonds is? The water consumption alone is astronomical. But that gets a pass, right? So far, it kind of gets a pass, but you're starting to see that change a little bit. You're seeing more in the mainstream press about, you know, that very issue, as a matter of fact. I saw something the other day. But so, yeah, there's just there's so many interesting angles to this. And, you know, obviously, like you said, we'll be covering it, you know, for probably years to come, I imagine.
We're going to have to get a reporter specifically on the plant-based beat. For now, it's kind of you. I mean, it's been coming on your plate more than anybody else's. So, I mean, it's going to really be interesting, and it may not all be bad. You pointed out to dairy. One thing about plant-based is it can be kind of a beef killer in a way too. I think that's the sector that's going to suffer the most from this. And I know you're a milk lover, but to me, I think rightly so. We need to think about reduction in red meat consumption. But
although, do note, my dear friend, that meat consumption is at record levels in the United States right now. Just throwing that out there. Just letting that go.
Oh man! All right. Well, I hate to end it on you scoring a point, but we must. Now, we have a lot of great stories coming up this week, so please keep your eye on the site. Remember that you can find us at intrafish.com. You can also click on the menu and subscribe to any number of newsletters, the Americas newsletter, European newsletter, aquaculture, salmon, editor's picks. There's so many different ways that you can keep up with the seafood news that's important to you. And also, we've got some exciting news coming up. Can't quite talk about it just yet, but we have a new product launch. Keep your eyes on the Apple and Google Play stores, and it's going to be out soon. Maybe it is already out. Maybe you want to just go and take a search. If you do, let us know what you think. And yeah, we're really excited about rolling this one out. All right, thanks, folks. We'll talk to you next time.